Welcome to another episode of Living with Dying, the podcast where we try to demystify death and dying a bit. And this week, I'm in the House of Lords, and I'm really thrilled to be with Lord Kinnock. I'm honoured that you're speaking to me. Very kind of you to join in. And I know you lost your lovely wife, Glenys, not that long ago, did you?
No, you lost December of 2023, yes, that's right. And it's very good to have you here in my tiny brush cupboard of an office, because I think what you do is a really useful public service.
Oh, that's kind of you to say so. It started, as you may know, when I lost my husband, Michael, yes. And I couldn't think what to do with the rest of my life, really. And then I found that other widows were in an equally lost position as I was, so it seemed sensible to try and do a podcast which would help other people find their way through, really,
yeah. And
find a way forward.
That's a good instinct.
So can I start by asking you, I mean, you were married to Glenys for a long, long time, and you were like the most well-known political couple in the UK, weren't you, really? Because you were both involved in politics.
Yes.
Individually.
Yes.
In your own right.
Well, Glenys, her profession was a teacher, and she decided extraordinarily out of the blue and astounded me at the age of 50 that she was going to run the European Parliament, having, on countless occasions, refused kindly invitations to run for this constituency or that. And basically, it was because she'd been looking after the kids. And it was no accident that she raised the issue of running when we were going down to Bristol for the first time to see our daughter in university. And I think that Glenys felt that the nest was neatly empty, and so she could get on with the rest of her life. So she was 50 before she became a real full-time politician.
But you had that in common, so I guess that must have made your relationship even better, in a way.
In common, indeed, from the first day. Her first words to me in the Students' Union in Cardiff University were, "Are you the man from Socialist Society?" And poor girl, it was her first day in university. I'd been there for a year. And then we started going out with each other immediately, and with one or two bumps and diversions, we were together for 60 years.
That's a very long time.
Yeah.
You grow almost to become one, don't you?
You do, yes. In the most satisfactory way. Because it's entertaining, enthralling, reassuring, certainly for me. And it's a whole bundle of things, especially if you are loving friends, because both of those words are very, very, very significant. Yeah.
Loving and friends.
And friends, mates, mockers occasionally, and fanatical fans sometimes when it's necessary. So all those things mixed in, yeah.
I remember when Mike died, we'd been together 47 years, not as long as you. It felt like half of me had gone.
Oh, yeah. Yes, it is like losing a limb. The only thing is, Glenys suffered and died of Alzheimer's. And the only real relief of Alzheimer's is that people slip away. They almost give you a rehearsal in loss. It does mean, of course, that you suffer a real death, and years before that, a sort of death. And you don't get a chance to mourn, of course, because you've got to get on with life, helping and hoping and supporting, and in the end, nursing. But it does mean that when it eventually happens, there's a sense of relief which does assuage the grief. There's no doubt about that. So Alzheimer's is not to be recommended. It's a very tough way for people to die, but in a peculiar, odd way, it makes the process easier to handle and to deal with. And there is that sense of almost gratitude when it's all over.
For her sake?
Yeah. Yeah, very much.
Can you remember what it was like when you first got the diagnosis?
Yes, it was in February 2017. And my daughter, Rachel, we're very fortunate. She and her family live in the next street. And we've always been very close-knit. So is Steve, our son, who doesn't live very far away, 20 minutes away. And so everything we determine is in family council. And it's always by fairly brief discussion, because we've probably agreed individual and privately beforehand. So it's all very easy, always been very easy. No tension of any description. So Rachel and her husband, who of course we saw very frequently because they were around the corner and we helped with the upbringing of the kids, they noticed the summer before on holiday that Dennis was missing words and introducing subjects and thoughts that were completely disjointed from whatever conversation was going on, which was very uncharacteristic of Glennis. She was a very, very organized person in deed and thought. So eventually, Rachel said to me before Christmas of 2016, I think we ought to get somebody to have a chat to Mum. When you're living with someone day by day, and very close, you really have to pause if you're going to take stock and comprehend that things have changed. At that point, I did that and said, yes, okay. So I talked it over with Dennis, who was very much in possession of her faculties. And she said, yes, she'd noticed some silly errors and shortage of memory and difficulty in recognizing things. So I said, okay, let's talk to somebody who knows about it. So we then had a consultation with a specialist who was employed by the memory service of Camden and Islington. Very, very fortunate that we still got that service despite the cuts over the last years. And he was a very helpful guy who was gentle and thorough and concluded that she had started on the journey of Alzheimer's. But he also advised that for a period it would be scarcely noticeable and that Dennis wasn't to be treated like an invalid. And that was very good advice. I mean, there was no chance that she would allow herself to be regarded as an invalid. So that part was easy. And it wasn't until 2020 when coronavirus descended and changed everybody's life that it became obvious that I was having difficulty looking after it by myself. And as it happens, I got a chest infection. You can probably hear that in my voice now. And I had to go into hospital for the first and only time in my life. And while I was in hospital, Rachel took the decision in characteristic fashion that I should have help. So she got, initially for just a couple of hours a day, terrific Filipino women who were expert, really top quality ladies. They were wonderful to come and help me. And over the subsequent years, we extended it to 4 hours a day. By the time Dennis died in December 2023, it was up to eight and a half hours a day. And it saved my life. So that was the narrative of the journey, really, as she deteriorated. What I discovered about Alzheimer's, though of course every case is dissimilar and individual, but I think without dangerous generalization, it becomes apparent that people's mentality, their consciousness, slips onto a plateau. And then without any real warning, there is on one day, for no apparent reason, a fairly precipitous drop to another plateau. And the plateaus can last for weeks, even a few months, so that you adjust to a different rhythm of attention, of care, and you deal after a few days with the new challenge of management and care. And I mean, I was massively assisted by having a wonderfully attentive and inventive young Filipino women in who developed beautiful relationships with Dennis. And that was a lifesaver. It made her existence much more full and interesting. And it meant that I could undertake something resembling normal life. It couldn't be normal, but it did give me hours in the day when I could read and follow my own interests and activities, which, of course, is a massive luxury. The thing is, of course, what bothered me throughout was that Dennis and I, were in the immensely fortunate position of being able to pay for care and to pay properly, decent wages for these wonderful women. And at the end, one man who was a trained nurse and utterly, utterly, utterly brilliant. And I couldn't envisage what would have happened if I couldn't have afforded it. And by God, I feel so sorry for the people who haven't got those resources, because it is a very large amount of money.
And as you say, if you had not had that help, you might not be here today.
I think that's quite probable, yes.
Which is shocking, isn't it, when you look at it?
Well, it is, especially since we've known for many decades about the ageing of our society, even about the reality that in the process of that demographic change, there will be a certain acceleration of it simply because of the advances of medical science. So we could expect to encounter mental and physical conditions that were barely evident before because people died. Now, Dennis was a fit woman, and she was physically fit until about maybe 5 or 6 months before she died. And without Alzheimer's, I guess it would have been reasonable to expect that she would outlive me, because she hadn't smoked for nearly 50 years. She'd never been a heavy drinker or anything like that, and had always exercised and kept herself very much away intellectually. So, but for this Alzheimer's, she could have expected to live a long time. But, of course, in the very nature of things, if we'd been part of previous generations, something else might have intervened before Alzheimer's could take hold. There has been virtually no preparation in our society or several others for the realities of this gigantic demographic change. And we're still, almost as a society, sprawling helplessly, witnessing a social care emergency, which the professionals in the field, and indeed ministers, as it happens, my son is the minister for social care, amongst several other things. And everybody's trying, but unless we say, look, this is part of modern reality, we'd better invest properly in it so that people don't have to bankrupt themselves paying for care or suffer the consequences of being utterly unable to care. There's got to be a collective answer to this collective problem, which takes individual forms. And unless and until, as a society, as a civilization, we do that, we're always going to be in a state of perpetual injustice. And that would be wrong.
And you and I are part of the baby boom generation.
Yes.
We've had our way all the way through our lives virtually, haven't we? We've
yes.
pioneered things, but we've also enjoyed the benefits of things. And we should have done something about it.
Of course we should. I mean, I'm not pointing accusatory fingers. But I have to say, for instance, if we'd been elected in 87 or 92, we would have been several years further down the track of making comprehensive provision for retirement, for old age. Not because we were dramatically aware of the challenges of demographic change, but simply because we thought old people needed a square deal, and our commitment to the health service, including what used to be called geriatric medicine, was very, very strong. But of course, we couldn't persuade the British public, and those advances weren't made. The Blair and Brown governments really made a very, very strong commitment, record investments in poverty reduction and in the development of the health and care services. But they would be the first to acknowledge, not enough. It had to be ongoing. The record had to be unbroken. And unfortunately, it was broken. So we are now left in the 2020s with this monumental challenge. I mean, you're younger than I am, but you're right to say we're part of a generation. I call us the lucky generation.
Mm, absolutely.
I was born in 1942. Just in time to be absolutely certain of free secondary education, compulsory until I was 15, of effectively free university education with no fees for university and a grant. My wife similarly. And when we graduated, we decided before we graduated that we were going to get married. And it didn't occur to either of us, and we reflected on this years and years later, that we'd do anything other than buy our own house, which we did. We got married on a Saturday. Our first night in our new house was on the Monday.
Wow.
And all our friends from university, all of them, did exactly the same thing. Now, that level of security and certainty produces a certain kind of strength, confidence, but it also produces complacency. And I'm afraid that in some areas of public policy, the complacency is dominated.
Very interesting to hear your reflections on that.
Well, it's none of us should ever take any advantage for granted. Most advantages are inherited one way or another, either because of our genes or because of the time in which we were born and the means by which we were brought up. I mean, I was very lucky in that respect too. But The fact is, even though we shouldn't take it for granted, we do. We do.
And we have done for
a long time. Yes.
So coming back to those wonderful carers who looked after Glenys, and yes. I'm so sorry to be upsetting you so much.
No, you're shedding tears throughout
this chat.
It's fine. But
coming back to, you talked about them having some fun together, Glenys and the carers,
yeah.
which was lovely. And I'm wondering how much she knew of what was going on for her as the years went by.
Well, the other feature, certainly up until the last maybe year, of Alzheimer's, was that periodically she'd be aware of deficiencies. And this, when it occurs in some people, makes them extremely agitated and can even make them aggressive. Never had that effect at all with Glenys, but she did manifest frustration. Why am I like this? Never in any denunciatory way, certainly without accusation. But she was mystified by it. And of course, there's no answer. You can't say it's because you fell down or because of the drugs you've been taking or because you drunk too much or smoked too much or were in the sun too much or got cold too often. You can't offer an explanation. And that too is a frustration. And then in a sense, Alzheimer's is a balm because the discomfort, mental discomfort, does not last long. It fades away after minutes, certainly a couple of hours. And then normal lack of service is resumed. So, in a sense, the disease has got its own antidote, that people can't be conscious of illness because it produces lack of consciousness, which is evil, but nevertheless also benign. It's confusion in terms, I know, but that's the reality.
But what's it like for you then? What's it like for the partner to have to watch this gradual progression?
Well, in a peculiar way, in a strange way, I grieved for her because of what she was missing out. As long as she was there, I didn't really mind much. I think that people who have cared for, nursed, lived with the terminally ill, I've talked to other people about it. They adjust to the extent that they value the continued presence. And so they're not overwhelmed by the sense of despair to which you could easily succumb if you really sat down and felt desperate. And of course, some people do, God help them. They do, but to some extent, I have to confess, I avoided reflecting. I would deliberately seek the diversion of a book or a film or a conversation to avoid thinking what's it going to be like next month? How are we going to manage this, that and the other thing? Why can't we do this? Why can't we do that?
I've noticed there's been an ad on television and radio recently where somebody says, I first lost my mum when she didn't remember my name.
Yes.
I then lost her again when she didn't remember how to cook a Sunday roast.
Yeah.
It sounds like a whole load of losses come one after the other.
Yes.
Is that what it feels like?
Yeah, that's true. But I've heard that advertisement, and it's certainly very well intentioned, and I think will have a real effect on some people in reassuring them that if they can make an advert about it, it isn't just they who are experiencing that change. But for me, there were two departures. The first, when I was told, we were told, that Glenys had this mortal affliction. And the second time, of course, was when it really happened. And in between those times, there were points of pressure and concern, frustration, but they never felt like death. They never felt like a complete loss of moorings. So maybe my experience is more fortunate than that of other people.
So when she died, that's what you experienced. Was it a complete loss of moorings?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, some people can develop a relationship of interdependence maybe very, very quickly. And I think we probably had that pretty much before we were married. But by the time we got into our 70s, it was total. I mean, Glenys especially could anticipate my every thought. But I used to say that was because she was from Anglesey, descended from the Druids, and therefore a witch. And without kind of joke, you having families. But the interdependence was total. And it wasn't cloying or fawning. And it didn't reduce independence either with our personalities, our characteristics. It couldn't. But it was a particular kind of luxury. I suppose luxury is the word, yeah. Yeah.
Not many people are lucky enough to have that, are they?
No. Yeah, I think that's, you're probably right there, yeah.
But I guess it makes it harder.
Yes. I suppose the fact that we were interdependent and not dependent makes everything a bit easier. But of course, in married life, in this partnership, you develop specialities. I can't say I never cooked. I can say I never cooked successfully. And she could say she never cooked unsuccessfully. She was a brilliant cook. But when it came to fixing anything or managing our financial affairs, it's yours, that's yours. And I'd say, why, because I'm the man? No, because I haven't got time. And so in that sense, she might have had more difficulty if I died first than I've had. But I've always been glad that she wasn't left alone. You reflect on these things with people of all kinds and at all times. I mean, as it happens, my father died. It was just 8 days before my mother died. And in that 8 days, I always felt, and talked to Glenys about it, quite relieved that he'd gone first. Because if she died and left him, this was a strong, intelligent guy who didn't have a clue, not any idea about how to run things. She did everything. And, I mean, it was only for 8 days, but if it had been for 10 years, I know I would have had that feeling. And in a sense, it isn't that Glenys didn't have a clue or anything like that, but she never had to do it. So it is just as well that she never would have to do it, you know? So it goes, yeah.
But yeah. How are you doing now then with things like cooking?
Oh, I get along. I mean, Rachel is great round the corner. Rarely miss a week when I don't see Steve and we have a meal together. If he's in London, we have a meal together because he's in his constituency a lot and so on. Yeah, there are very few weeks that we don't get together. And then it's very easy these days, of course. If you've got any idea about how to do a chop or a steak. And then, of course, I've got mates that I tend to have lunch or dinner with. And one meal a day is fine for me. So that gives me no problems at all. I do miss her cooking.
You miss her hugely, don't you? It seems superfluous for me to ask you how you're getting on because you're missing her every minute.
Yeah, that's true. It would be very, very strange if I didn't, after all that time.
You've been very generous with your time and sharing your emotions with me. Thank you so much for that.
I'm sorry about all the waterworks.
Just shows you care. Thank you so much, Lord Kinnock, for talking to me.
You're more than welcome.
Death is never easy. But there are ways we can help each other through it. And if you've found any of these episodes helpful, please think about liking and sharing. And if you can help spread the word by telling just one other person, thank you. And a huge thanks to Joe Barrett, without whom these podcasts would simply not be possible. You can contact us on hello@livingwithdying.co.uk.